welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, everybody. This is Barney Leventino at Syosset Library. Welcome to the latest chapter of Turn the Page. My guest today, very excited to speak to him, Alan Winter. Alan, you, along with Herbert Stern, are authors of a couple of interesting books that take place in and around Berlin in the first half of the century. Before we get into the book, and the new book, by the way, is called Sins of the Fathers. Before we get into the book, reading your bio and Herbert Stern's bios, how did you two come to collaborate on these novels?
Well, I know Herb for almost 40 years, and he knows that I've been a writer. I have had another career, so I can talk about that in a second. But we know each other for 40 years. He knows I wrote books. He said, look, and I asked him an idea. He's an attorney amongst his other credits. He was a prosecutor. He was a federal judge. And I asked him about an idea I had about a book for a lawyer. He goes, nah, you don't want to write about that. You want to write about Hitler. I go, why? Why? What could you possibly say that hasn't been said before? And this was about 5 years ago. And that started this journey. He said, let's have dinner. And he slowly spoon-fed me information that he had been studying for almost 60 years. And he hooked me. And the story was amazing. It really was. And that's how we started.
Okay. So now let's get into the book. Again, this is the second book in what I suspect is going to be at least a trilogy. I'm guessing there's going to be another book down the pike. This book is Sins of the Fathers. Tell us a little bit about where this is set and a little bit about your protagonist, who's an interesting character.
Sure. Well, I mean, it is a sequel to Wolf. Wolf is the first book, and Wolf was what Hitler called himself. He had his own pseudonym that he would go around picking up women and things like that and sign everything Wolf. So this takes place in Berlin and Germany, for that matter. I mean, it's all over. But it is Sins of the Father is specifically from 1934 to 1938, to Kristallnacht. 34, because that is when Hindenburg died in August of 34. And Hitler did away with the office of presidency of Germany, combined it with his chancellorship. And he then became the Führer, which is what we've known him to be or called him through all these years. The Führer means leader. And in abolishing the office, he then declared himself dictator, had a plebiscite on August 19th of 34. And that's where this book begins. And our protagonist, and this is critical to both stories and it's important to understand, is that, and if I go back a little bit, I think it's easier to say it this way. When Herb said, let me go back to your intro. When Herb said, let's write a book about Hitler. And so what's new? He said, well, for instance, Hitler was in a mental institution. No one writes about it. The historians don't write about it. And I said, oh, and we researched it and it was true. And if you read every history book, every biography of Hitler, it does not mention that he was in a mental institution. They talk about a hospital at the end of the war because everybody is familiar, or most people are, that he was exposed to gas in a gas attack and it affected his eyes. Well, the other soldiers in the trenches with him literally went to an eye wash station. They washed their eyes out with water, then went back to fight. Hitler was ranting and raving, I'm blind, I'm blind, I'm blind. And he made such a fuss, they sent him 600 miles away to Pomerania to Pasewalk Hospital. And Pasewalk Hospital had a mental ward. And that's why they sent him there. And he was diagnosed by a psychiatrist. So what we wanted to do was correct history, because in essence, history has been censored, and I can get into that with you in a moment. And how were we going to correct history if all the historians and all the biographers did what they did, which was to literally avoid this and many other topics, which we have in our books? So we created, and the guy in the bed next to Hitler, in other words, who was in the bed next to Hitler, he's our protagonist. And we created a man who was in a battle and he lost his memory. He has no idea who he is. So he's a tabula rasa. So he's a German because he speaks German, that they were able to determine, but he's not an anti-Semite. He's not anything. And the only person in the world that talks to him is the guy in the bed next to him. It happens to be Adolf Hitler. This is 1918. And so through his eyes, we've created an ability for the reader to get an inside view of Germany, how the Nazis came to power, how they slowly, methodically disenfranchised the Jews from their society until it led to the culmination in this book of Sins of the Father of Kristallnacht.
The mechanism really is fascinating in terms of how you told the story through Friedrich Richards' eyes. Again, starting with this person, as you're describing, as a tabula rasa, it really was the only way to tell the story without having the pre-existing experiences, the mores, the philosophies of the particular individual influence the manner in which they observe what's going on. And his development, his relationship with Hitler begins on really a very, very human level. I see this person who needs help and I'm going to help him. And as the stories progress, his blank slate begins to be filled in, and his attitude, while he still recognizes the humanity in Hitler, he's seeing the progress and where this whole thing is leading. And it really was a fascinating mechanism for you guys as writers to come up with and to tell the stories. It was interesting.
Thank you. Well, I don't think there was another way to tell it. I mean, if you think about what any of us know historically of the characters that were in the Nazi inner circle, Goebbels and Goering and Himmler and Heydrich and whomever you want to name, they really didn't turn on Hitler. They didn't reveal his secrets. And we had to create this new character. And then the fact that he was not an anti-Semite allowed us to get into the heads as best we were capable of what did the everyday German experience, what happened as their rights were taken away. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, this guy becomes chancellor when everybody thought he was a buffoon, including the leaders of Germany at the time, Hindenburg and the Bruning, who was the chancellor before, and Stryker, the different people before Hitler as chancellor. And it allowed us to, as you said, talk to him as a man. That's one of the reasons we wrote this. If we are looking, we, the population of the world, America, Jews, are looking for the next despot, the next person who's going to be so anti-Semitic that our lives are in jeopardy. And we don't have to look very far anymore. I think the Times have pointed things out as recently as Texas. Then how did this happen? How did it really happen? And, you know, that was the purpose of this, is to show that Hitler was a man too, as are other dictators and other despots.
I made a note as I was thinking about this conversation we're going to have that the history that we read, you know, you read black and white names, dates, places, and it removes from oftentimes the context and the humanity of the people who are involved in these events. And this story, for our readers who, listeners who have not read the book yet, Friedrich interacts with real historical characters in and around real historical events. And it puts those events in a context that it's a little bit easier to, I don't want to say understand, because you can't really understand and wrap your head around the atrocities that these people committed. But what you can see is the interplay among flesh and blood human beings and the dialogue and the way they kind of collectively came to these decisions, as horrendous as the decisions were, it kind of puts it into a real perspective for somebody, rather than, you know, on page 587 of my history book, this happened. And it makes it a little bit more real for people who, you know, obviously haven't lived through it in the past. And it's an interesting story on that line. It's fascinating in terms of what I learned along the way, a lot of the minutia of the history. So you're both historians, which makes it even better.
Well, we're not. That's the interesting thing. We're not historians, neither of us.
Well, you have a history degree, don't you?
I do have a history degree.
Okay, but you don't call yourself a historian. Okay. You
know, because I know so much about history that I think I should know more. But what you're saying is very, very important. One of the things that happened when we did a deep dive into this is that we realized that historians, and I'm going to try and answer this in two different ways, or say this in two different ways, historians censored history. They censored the history of Hitler and they censored the history of the Nazis. They didn't censor the Holocaust, obviously. And we know the classic things that all of us know. That's not censored. What's censored is they didn't know how to deal with Hitler the man and the German people in general, that how could you account for the atrocities that happened after? How could you account for Kristallnacht? How could you account for the extermination camps, the Einsatzgruppen, where the soldiers followed the German army into Russia and killed a million something, you know, point blank? How do you explain humanity or human beings doing this to other humans? And so what happens is the majority of us have been exposed from childhood on of viewing these Germans, these Nazis, these capos in the concentration camps, the guards, whoever it may be, every story that we see on Netflix, as monsters, as people who followed orders, who had a choice and didn't elect to do, quote unquote, the right thing. And it really wasn't quite the case like that. It really wasn't. They're monsters in what happened. I don't want to say this the wrong way. But they went home to have dinner. They went home to their families. And how far would any of us go with literally saying, if you don't do the following, your entire family will be eliminated? And I'm talking about the Germans. You know, when you took some block warden in any city in Berlin and said, if you don't turn in so-and-so and you don't tell me who the Jews are in your neighborhood, your whole family will be thrown out on the street. What's the dividing line for all of us between morality and doing the right thing and following in order? And so we needed to be accurate with everything. And what we began to find is that the historians did not portray Hitler as a human with all the warts that he had. They called him an unhuman, a subhuman, a black hole, all this other stuff. And, you know, he put his pants on one leg at a time like we do. And that was important for us to get out there, because if you don't realize that, you miss the next despot coming along.
You know, again, we get now to another note that I made here, and that is that history is not static. And we read about these events in the past, and there are so many parallels that occur at different times, and that we're seeing there are a lot of parallels going on right now that are on a lot of levels really frightening. In terms of what we're seeing, we're seeing elected officials either claiming that an election was rigged, or current officials saying that the next election is going to be rigged. And you now have some from both sides this questioning of the legitimacy of the process, and the lessons that we need to take from the past. That these were human beings, these were people, these were events that were happening piecemeal, and they kind of steamrolled out of control. And we need to be very, very wary about that. And I suspect that there's a little bit of that undertone, and I think that was kind of part of where you guys were going with the books.
Well, we were, and The sad part is the more we wrote the books, the more apparent it became that while we were writing about something that was 80 and 90 years ago and 100 years ago, it was apropos today. I am concerned for America in that right now. I am concerned for democracy. That when you read our book, and then I suggest to your readers, if they're not familiar, go read It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis, which was written in 1935. And it was about a fascist takeover of America, 1935. And it is scary. And one of the things, and we've been writing some essays that we're submitting for editorials, et cetera, right now, is that at what point do you speak up? At what point does an individual do something? When do you turn away and say, well, you know, that's not me. It's not my family. It happened in Texas. It happened in Belgium. It happened wherever it was, but it's not me. And I think the great problem, the great lesson we learned doing this research was that you need to speak up, that if you remain neutral, if an individual remains neutral, a family, and then a country, or then a leader of a country remains neutral. And we can talk about Chamberlain in a second, because I think that's important.
Yeah, I'll get into the substance of the book. Yeah,
if you remain neutral, you are helping the bad guys. It's that simple. You are allowing them to continue. And as they chip away one right and one freedom, you know, chip by chip by chip. You know, at the end of the day, if you start with a stone and you're a sculptor and you keep on chipping, eventually you're going to have a form and a shape that looks like something. And our democracy is being chipped away like that right now. And let me just add before you ask your next question, Martin.
No, that's okay.
One of the CNN newscasters the other day was talking about Biden and the Ukraine and saying that this is Biden's Chamberlain moment. And I agree with him. And I think that things that President Biden said yesterday were wrong. And I'm talking for myself. I'm not talking for my co-author at all. I think that you can't give an inch, because when you give an inch, you give a mile. It's a cliche, but it's true. And I think that we're at a tipping point right now in history that we may regret things that are going on, that we are looking the other way.
I want to get into the substance of the book and the story that you're talking about, because it kind of ties in with what we're talking about in terms of when do you speak up and what do you say. A significant element of the story that you tell is the attempt by a group of insiders who kind of saw where things were going and tried to stop it. Admiral Canaris's group that tried to stop things before it got too far. They were unsuccessful, and you mentioned Chamberlain, and that kind of played into it. You want to elaborate and talk a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Another lesson that we learned when we were doing this, and you have to understand, I'm Jewish, Herb's Jewish. We grew up, lost family in the concentration camps. It's not like we are trying to sugarcoat history or do anything. We're just trying to be objective. And what one realizes is that not all Germans at that moment in time were bad. Not every single German was a Nazi. A few of them were, as a matter of fact. And it goes to what we were just talking about, is when do you do something? So what the heads of military, specifically what you're referring to and what the book is about, is they realized that Hitler in 1937, 1938 was on a collision course to start another great war. At that point, they really didn't use World War as a name for it, because, you know, World War I that we know was the Great War. But they said another great war, another war that will take over Europe. And they said, we're going to lose. That, and it wasn't that because they were military men, they were afraid of losing a war. They realized how devastating the war would be, both to Germany, to their people, and they're going to lose again. And there's no point to it, because what they then realized is Hitler is crazy. We need to talk about that too before we, you know, end. And so the military leaders, the heads, the chief of staff, the head of the army, the head of the Department of War, literally began to form a resistance group to plot how to overthrow Hitler. This was in 1938. And realized that had they succeeded, and I'll go back to in a minute, there would not have been World War II, there would not have been the Holocaust, there wouldn't have been Kristallnacht. But what happened was they slowly began to bring in more military leaders. They brought in politicians. They brought in the equivalent of the Secretary of State. They brought in embassy people. They brought in clergy. And they brought in their whole spy network under Canaris that you mentioned. He was head of the ABWAR, which was their external espionage around the world. They all were beginning to figure out how they could take down Hitler. And what they did was they sent an emissary to England to meet with Chamberlain in August of 38. This was not the first emissary. There were some sent in 37. There were those sent to the French, to the Swiss, along the way. And it culminated in August of 38. It was Baron Kleist, Schmensen was his name. And he went with letters basically of reference to say, to meet with Chamberlain and say, look, all you need to do is England publicly say, Hitler, if you go into Czechoslovakia, then we will come to the aid of the Czechs. And it's important to understand that the French and the Russians had signed a pact to support the Czechs, and England would always support France. So in essence, the German generals knew that if Hitler crossed the border or the frontier into Germany, that you would have France, Russia, and England creating a war against Britain. The key here was that Hitler was smarter than all of them. He knew that they wouldn't do it. He read the people the right way for him. And Chamberlain was the great appeaser. Chamberlain refused to see the emissary that was sent by the German generals. And the reason they needed England to step up was because the lower level military in Germany had signed an oath to Hitler. And this is important to understand. And it's important for our country to understand going forward. When our officials swear to anything in America, they swear to the Constitution, will uphold the Constitution. Well, that was the same in the Weimar Republic. But when Hitler took over and became dictator in August of 34, where our book started, he changed that. So the oath was to support him. So now you have these second tier military people said, we supported Hitler. We signed an oath that we're going to support this man. And they had this big conflict where military men, we follow orders, but there's a morality. And the German heads of military said, all we need is someone to step up so we can use them as leverage. And in the last moment, they had the roads that they were going to block. They knew who was going to, I don't want to ruin the story. They knew who was going to surround the chancellery, who was going to take down Hitler, what was going to happen. And at the last moment, Chamberlain made a secret flight, first time he was ever on an airplane, to Munich to meet with Hitler. And you know that's the Munich Agreement that everybody knows about. And if that didn't happen, the world would be different.
And while this is going on, Churchill is chafing in the background because he saw what was happening.
He got it. Churchill got it. So it turns out that Chamberlain would not meet with these men. He allowed Chamberlain to see them. And when we did our research, we realized Chamberlain, as much as he was chafing, still
Churchill.
Did it. Churchill, no, I'm sorry. You're right. Churchill, he still did it with, I think, Chamberlain's approval. And because at the end of the day, he did write a letter of support for the German resistors, but he passed it through Chamberlain. So Chamberlain knew that had he spoken up, Hitler would have been taken down. He knew it. And there's a new Netflix movie coming out that Robert Harris wrote, the book called Munich, that gives Chamberlain a pass. He writes it in a more glowing terms that Chamberlain is not a bad guy, or I don't know if he's a bad guy, that's not the right word, that he didn't capitulate to Hitler, or he did what was right, et cetera, et cetera. I think he's wrong. He's absolutely wrong. That Chamberlain was the wrong man at the wrong time, and had Churchill been there or Anthony Eden, they would have stood up to Hitler.
Timing, unfortunately.
It's all about timing. But again, that's, and the resistors just didn't have the strength. And there's one other thing. The question would be, why didn't the resistors do it anyway? If they believed so strongly that he was a bad guy, they had to bring him down. He was the most popular man in the world, not in Germany, in the world. That the British royalty loved him. Many people in America loved him. Around the world, he was revered by so many or respected by so many. And this is not a spoiler. The Time magazine made him Man of the Year in 1938. You're talking about Man of the Year.
As I was reading the books, and again, the mechanism of having your character interacting with live people, live events, Friedrich had an opportunity. He helped Bernard Weiss get out of Germany, and he had an opportunity to stay out. And Bernard Weiss, who had previously been the head of the, for filling people in, the Berlin police force, kind of talked him back in to go back in and be my eyes, be my ears, and help me try to stop this as well. So Bernard was outside trying to work from the outside to stop it as well. And Friedrich turned around and said, okay, I'll do this. And he went back into harm's way, as it were. As I was reading the relationship between Friedrich and Bernard Weiss, I called to mind the Philip Kerr novels, the Bernie Gunther books, particularly the Berlin trilogy, which you have the same mechanism. You have a relationship there between, you know, again, Bernard Weiss is instrumental in those books, along with Bernie Gunther, who was a Berlin detective. And I started thinking a little bit about the two characters, excuse me. And your protagonist is there. He's seeing what's going on, and he's trying to influence things in a not a heavy-handed way, as much as Bernie Gunther, who was in the mix as a detective, was kind of forced into really getting his hands dirty in a lot of times. So the two characters are different in that way, but it called to mind those books, and I just thought I'd throw that out there. I'm sure.
Well, here's one of the, you know, if you realize we dedicated Wolf, the first book, to Bernard Weiss. Bernard Weiss, for the readers, was not only the head of the police, the head of the Prussian police is the highest level of authority, basically, in the country at that time. This is before Hitler took over. He was the only Jew in Germany, and this is important to underscore, the only Jew in Germany in the 1920s to stand up to the Nazis. He sued Joseph Goebbels multiple times for blasphemy and defamation, and he won. He went to court and won every single time. And the moment that, you know, Hitler took over, they put a death warrant out or an arrest warrant out for him, and he had to flee. And this is all true. But he became a perfect person for us to have our character continue. And you bring up a good point. Like, we had Friedrich in Prague, where is in true life, that's where Bernard Weiss went until he had to leave Prague and go to London. And he could have stayed away. But our character is the reader. And I think what we tried to do, and hopefully we accomplished it, we have the reader inside the book. We have the reader inside Germany. We have the reader inside the meetings. And by the way, the majority of dialogue that is in the book, when it comes from the big names that you know, those are what the words they used. We took it from memoirs, from transcripts, from different reports. We tried to be very faithful to show this. And yet this is not a polemic. This is not a didactic book. It's not a history book. I don't want to scare the readers. Those who like suspense thrillers, this is a suspense thriller to the last page. And especially, you know, Sins of the Father, you have no idea where this is going, even as it's unfolding.
You're now bringing up another point, the title of the book and Sins of the Fathers, fathers, plural. And I kind of looked at it as there were two, and I'm not going to give us any spoilers here, but the title kind of hit home to me literally in the last page of the book. And I don't know if I missed the point or not,
okay. But
and there were two fathers involved. And one, you're talking about going back to, we have to discuss Hitler was crazy, and you question whether his own father had something to do with that. And the brutality of his own father, who apparently was not exactly a candidate for man of the year. And then again, at the end of the book, the coda to that story, which I don't think is the end of the story, but it really, that's when it fell into place for me. And I guess that's kind of where you guys were going with it.
Well, you know, yes, everything you just said is absolutely correct, but there's also a bigger story with the title, Sins of the Fathers. Because when you read Deuteronomy chapter 5 and you talk about the commandments and, you know, God says, you shall have no other God before me. And if not, he's going to wreak havoc afterwards on the generations that follow. That's another interpretation of sins of the fathers. And we actually quote Deuteronomy, you know, in this. You have to realize one other thing. What did Hitler do? Hitler dismantled religion in Germany, not just the Jews, Christians, Protestants. He tried to get rid of the Protestant church. He tried to put it under one Nazi Protestant church. He got rid of the Jehovah's Witnesses. He got rid of a lot of different people, Catholics, oh my God. And so he basically became a god. He became Germany's new god. Nazism became their religion. When Albert Speer, who became his architect, made this enormous stadium, they would create it the Cathedral of Light. You know, he would have as if God descended from the earth, from the heavens, and on earth it is Adolf Hitler. And that's very important to understand, that that's another meaning to the title, Sins of the Fathers. And then the other one that I feel, and I'm going to speak for myself rather than my co-author, because he wouldn't go this way. Are children responsible for sins of the father? Or the fathers, plural. So are the German people, who are the younger people, responsible for what the older people did? Are they responsible for passing anti-Semitic comments on? I mean, where did anti-Semitism learn? But at home. And if children are possibly responsible for the sins of their fathers, are they responsible for correcting them? And so there's so much in this title for us and for me that, I want people to walk away after reading this and say, whoa, I got a lot to think about. I have a lot to talk about. Absolutely. And, one of our quotes by Steve Barry, he says, you'll be thinking about this book long after you've closed it, because there's so much in here. It really is.
It is, in terms of straight fiction and an exciting story, it's terrific. The history is a great approach in terms of fleshing out what we all know, you know, as the bare bones, and really filling in the details. So for me, it was great on that level as well. And just seeing, you know, the regular people, I'm thinking now, you know, Kitty Schmidt, I don't know if she's a regular person or not, but she was real. But in terms of, you know, making this person come alive. And again, I'm not going to read the book. You'll learn more about Kitty Schmidt. It's really terrific. I'm thinking, based on where we ended before the war really got underway, that we might be seeing more from you two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when do we look forward to that? When we look forward to that?
I don't know. At this moment, we've spent 5 years doing this nonstop. And I think only because of COVID, we were able to get this book out as quickly as we did. You know, there's an enormous amount of research went into this. We've published, by the way, all of our author's notes are going to be in Sins of the Father. There's going to be 30 or 40 pages of research if people really want to learn how this came about and what's true and what's not true. On Wolf, we've actually published it online called Notes on Wolf. We actually have an entire website dedicated to the research. We're still storytellers first, but the other thing, if I can say this, just as to who we are, Herb is a very well-known former prosecutor and federal judge and now litigating attorney. And both of our books are accurate with the characters because we want to present to the jury of historians, if you will, that they basically allowed Hitler to hide the truths of who he was. Because let me go back to this before we end, that Hitler wanted to make himself a god. Well, if you're a god, then you don't have girlfriends. You don't have affairs. You don't do this. You don't do that. You're above all that. And it's one thing to do that while you're alive and you're a dictator and you can control the press and you can control what people say about you. But it's another thing 70, 80, and 90 years later that the historians bought into it. And part of it was they didn't know how to handle him. I'm not going to blame them and castigate them as not doing their due diligence. They didn't know. It, rather than say a positive word or a word about his humanity, they chose to ignore it. And that's a disservice. And what we tried to do was correct that part of history.
Well, I appreciate the effort. The book is a great read. I have to say the timing, it came in a little late. So I'm actually reading the books out of order. I'm in the middle of Wolf right now. I kind of went back to the starting point. They're both terrific. Sins of the Father will be out in mid-February, and our podcast should be released just about the same time. So to our listeners, come on down. We'll have it here at the library. Alan, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate your time. Good luck with the next one, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. And with that, we will turn the page on this chapter of our podcast. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Have a good one. Thank you for everything.
You too.
Bye-bye. It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.